You know the drill. We start with the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch, read by Amy Herman, and then we go on to a conversation with Dr. Patrick Tripp about talking with patients and listening to their stories. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. A large database analysis comprising nearly 5 million patients who began blood pressure treatment with a single drug finds that diuretics are more effective and safer than ACE inhibitors. They're also used far less often than ACE inhibitors. Next, an international consensus group updated its 2010 guidelines on managing non-variceal upper gastrointestinal bleeding. The new recommendations address when to start resuscitation or blood transfusion, among other things. Elsewhere, the FDA expanded approval of the flu drug baloxavir marboxil, sold under the brand name Xofluza. It's now indicated for patients with acute, uncomplicated flu who are at high risk for developing serious flu-related complications. For example, patients with chronic conditions like asthma and heart disease. And in other FDA news, the agency approved the diabetes drug dapagliflozin to lower the risk for heart failure hospitalization in adults with type 2 diabetes who also have cardiovascular disease or are at high risk for it. The drug is a member of the SGLT2 inhibitor class. And finally, in a randomized trial, the beta blocker metoprolol was no better than placebo at lowering the risk for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease exacerbations in high-risk patients who did not have indications for beta blocker therapy. An editorialist says that the trial doesn't provide any support for these drugs in COPD patients without cardiovascular indications. And that's it for this week. Hang on for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
The other day, I decided to attend to a stack of unread magazines and journals. I came across the May 23rd, 2019 edition of the London Review of Books. Near the end of the tabloid-sized issue was a two-page spread, about 4,000 words of prose, and what caught my eye were the first words in the lead sentence, a pleural effusion. I read on without interruption to the end. It was by Patrick Tripp, a radiation oncologist. It consisted of fragments of conversations he'd had with several of his patients, all of whom were veterans of the Vietnam War. Dr. Tripp is an associate professor of clinical radiation oncology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He works at the Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Tripp.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, you're in a rather short line of physician writers on Vietnam. Ronald Glaser's 365 Days is one of the books. Another is 12, 20, and 5 by John Parrish, all of which came out pretty close to the, well, during the war, and they're still in print and still worth reading. And there's another one called Achilles in Vietnam, which is by a local psychiatrist, Jonathan Shea, who draws parallels between the Iliad and the experience of soldiers in the Vietnam War and in other wars. But to give our readers a sense of the vignettes that you've assembled from your patients, would you mind reading one for us?
Sure, absolutely. And this is from the LRB piece you pointed out, London Review of Books piece you pointed out.
Yeah.
A 66-year-old man with long, thin braided dreadlocks, wearing a forest green nylon tracksuit, had returned for a follow-up appointment. "It's been 5 years since you were treated for prostate cancer," I said. He looked up. "5 years? Unbelievable, right?" "Unbelievable," he said. "You can go. We'll do the same thing next year. PSA blood test. See you right after." I put a hand on the door. "Anything else?" "What about my PTSD, he said. "The doctors don't know how to treat PTSD in older men. There's no experience. As a younger man, I had my youth to protect me, drinking to close off your mind, or drugging out on the streets. But an older man can't drink so much. He can't be out drugging. It wasn't even known before the Vietnam vets showed up with it." "That's true," I said. "It wasn't recognized." "Where am I supposed to go? My psychiatrist, he'll put a hand on my arm and say, 'I know how you feel.' What do you mean you know how I feel? You weren't even born yet during Vietnam. How the fuck do you know how I feel? The doctors they got are babies. They don't know what's going on. I was illegal in Vietnam. I had my 18th birthday, 10 December 1967, Khe Sanh, Hill 18. We'll see you in a year. Sometimes these appointments are so far ahead of time, I forget, he said.
Thank you. Yeah, well, a lot of words to conjure with in that. What got you interested, Dr. Tripp, in these people's stories? Had you noticed over the course of your work that your patients were transitioning from people in the Korean War to people from the Vietnam War?
Yeah, that's true. I was actually thinking about it a little bit leading up to this conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I think clinicians who work at veterans hospitals are probably familiar with the phenomenon of patients arriving to clinic sometimes wearing a hat or a shirt from the time when that patient was in one war or another. I mean, these days we see a few patients with Iraq.
Yeah.
And it has struck me over the years that this experience for the Vietnam veterans now 50 years ago has become a part of them and has stayed with them to the extent that they walk into clinic wearing a hat. And it's, I don't think it's pride as much as just as this is who I am.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about it even more, you know, as an intern some years ago, I met some patients who were veterans from World War II, and I'd be talking at the bedside, and I remember a patient pulled from his wallet. Here's a photograph of me and my buddies on the plane that we were in together before we got shot down. And this patient carried, he's 83 years old, he carries this photograph around with him. It was, I'm not a veteran myself, but it has always struck me that these meaningful experiences, a young person that stays with someone for the rest of his life.
I've noticed watching on the History Channel that you get people who are in their 80s and 90s breaking down and crying as they're talking about their experiences. And you would think, and as a younger person, I thought, wow, does it stay with you forever? And apparently it does.
I think it does. I mean, we've seen patients day in and day out of clinic. We do meet a man now and then, a woman now and then, who recalls that experience, and it's right there next to him.
Yeah.
It's right with him.
Yeah. Do you have more of these stories? Are you edging toward a book-length collection of them?
It's interesting you should ask. I was interested in writing before I was interested in becoming a physician, and I have sent pieces to different literary magazines. I've had a couple pieces in a few other literary publications in addition to this one in London Review of Books, and I do continue to send out pieces to different literary publications, and that is something I've thought about, absolutely.
Well, you know, I looked you up. I said, who is this guy, Patrick Tripp? And so I looked you up, and the biographical detail shows that you weren't straight pre-med. You were a philosophy major.
I did not know that I would apply to medical school when I decided to become a philosophy major.
So how has existentialism served you?
I don't know if I think about it all the time. I just I had no plans at all when I was in college. I had no plans at all, and then it kind of caught me off guard. Oh my goodness! Now I need to do something.
Good for you.
I didn't know about it right away, but as I've gone along, I have found it suits me.
So for all the aspiring writers listening, talk to us about technique. You know, where do you set up when you decide you're going to write? What tools are always nearby? What time of day is it? And who do you give your stuff to read?
I try to not be very elaborate about it. My wife and I have a 2-year-old, so when she goes to sleep, I go downstairs and there's a computer and I try and write some and rewrite some and when I can, so to speak.
Yeah.
But usually in the evenings, try and do some.
So do you try to do this every a couple of times a week or
I usually do it every evening. I usually do it every evening.
good for you.
A little bit, at least a little bit of something.
Yeah. Now, getting back to those patients, somebody asked me today, I told them I was going to interview you, and he said, you know, when we talk with physicians and other clinicians, often we hear the complaint that they wish they had more time to talk with the people that they're treating. Do you, as a, you know, as a listener to some of these stories, wish that you had more time to hear longer stories from them?
Yes and no. I think, I mean, I can speak for my own circumstances. My wife's a cardiologist, actually, and she said, we don't have so much time with the patients. We got to put them through and move on.
Yeah.
And radiation oncology is a little bit different. There does tend to be a little bit more time that they sometimes the patients tend to be, I mean, how would I know? But to me, they seem complicated. They do tend to be complicated. And I would say at the VA in particular, there is less emphasis compared to other settings about seeing as many patients as possible. When I talk to colleagues, I do realize I'm fortunate that there is more time. And I would say that, you know, the vignettes that are in this piece in the London Review of Books, I don't have that similar experience with every patient. I would say I don't have that experience with most patients. But now and then, and I think it can a clinician in any setting can detect now and then a patient gives a signal that she or he wants to talk a little more, and it might be personal history, it might be something not related to the disease or its status right in front of her or him.
You talked about you're a radiation oncologist, so you see lots of cancers. And one of the things that I recall from my days as a draftee were the cigarettes. They were ubiquitous. And I don't think there's a single picture of me in Vietnam without a lucky strike in my hand. You know, but yeah. So those things catch up with you. It hasn't caught up with me yet, but do those stories from the vets have, you know, have you thought about, do they have something in common? I mean, I'm not trying to be a literary analyst here, but what do you think they're trying to tell you?
I do think there's something in common, and it's I was trying to articulate it earlier. It's that this experience from my life 50 years ago has stayed with me and has become a part of me. It's made me who I am. I think about it sometimes in the setting of I say we treat cancer the veteran, lung cancer, head and neck cancer, and some of the treatment regimens are pretty challenging. And hospitalizations or other problems just from the treatment itself, not even from the cancer. And sometimes before going forward, we obtain informed consent, and I say to a patient, well, there's a risk of hospitalization, there's a risk of death, and the patient seems unfazed. And I've even asked sometimes, I say, you know, I know that you're a veteran. I know you had this other experience. Maybe this is not the most difficult thing you've faced. And many times a man will smile and say, you're right. So there's something about, you know, I know this is a tough problem, life-threatening illness. Let's get on with it.
So you've got things out there now that you've submitted to other places, and that's it's. I think it's important for you to maybe share the stories with your patients. At some point, of course, there's always
Yeah, I think
HIPAA.
of that. I sometimes think, you know, cancer patients, the outcome is not always good. And
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder if telling the story is that, can that be a way that I might honor that patient?
Yeah. Huh.
That's one way I've looked at it, but.
And, you know, going back to the idea of patients and their stories, these are especially dramatic examples of patients' stories. Non-veteran patients also have interesting stories to tell. And I thought yours would be very interesting to discuss because they are the kind of the far example, you know, they're out on the far end of the curve of intensity. But do you think that that you've learned something as a physician from hearing these stories?
Yeah, undoubtedly. It's as you point out, you know, a non-veteran has a story also, and it, I think there's something about a life-threatening illness and challenging treatment. It seems like a taking stock, a kind of taking stock happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what I think in the patients we see at the Veterans Hospital, I think it's what prompts recollections of a different time. You know, these days as medical students and clinicians, we're taught, you know, be holistic in your care. Don't focus on the nephron or the alveolus.
Yeah.
Just, you know, look at the patient. And I think it's a reminder to, it's trite, but I think it's true, to look at the whole picture.
I don't think your patients would consider it trite for you to look at them as a complete entity.
What we all want. Of course, that's what we all want.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tripp, for taking
the
time.
Absolutely, it's an honor. Absolutely.
And I wanted to say to you, keep writing and keep curing.
Yeah, thank you for the encouragement. I need it for both. Thank you for the encouragement.
That was our 239th episode. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.